Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
These are books on the demonic. We're going to be dealing with the Gadarene demoniac today. Of all the subjects, I think I need some help, and you need some help on reference books in this area. Mark 5 is a very interesting chapter. It's going to deal with several things that happen right after Jesus calms the storm, which, of course, proves his power over nature. Now, I want to show you the outline of chapter 5, which continues the emphasis on Jesus' power over things. Let's look at the outline. First of all, we have Jesus' power over the demonic, over the spiritual realm and the Gadarene demoniac. Then we have Jesus' power over death in Jairus' daughter. And finally, we're going to have Jesus' power over disease in the woman with the issue of blood for so many years. We are trying to assert through these different selected miracles Jesus' cosmic power, the Son of God in all his beauty and brightness dealing with man's need. Now, you know, those disciples were out in the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus calmed the storm. I bet they were just thrilled to death about that until they realized they had to row to shore about 5 miles. I bet they were just bushed by the time they got there. It was the middle of the night. And lo and behold, here are these guys. They're coming to the area called Gadara. It's also often called, it's spelled different ways in every synoptic gospel. It's over in the area of the Decapolis. Look at the back at your Bible, the map of your Bible. I can say it. Look at in the map of the back of your Bible at the Sea of Galilee. The area to the north east is the area of Decapolis, very Gentile area. So lo and behold, here they are huffing and puffing because there's no wind, rowing, and they row into a graveyard. It's still night. And there's a high cliff, and this dude up on the cliff is screaming at the top of his lungs. Is it any wonder they let Jesus get out of the boat first? Let's look at it in chapter 5. So they landed on the shore on the other side of the sea in the region of Gersa, mine has, but it goes by several names. As soon as he got out of the boat, I could just hear them say, "Go right ahead, Lord, you can go first." A man. Now, as normal, Matthew has two men. Matthew 28:28 and following has two. That's a characteristic of Matthew. You just got to get used to that. Luke and Mark only have one. Matthew always has two. Under the power of a foul spirit. Now, this is a mostly Gentile area, and this is an obvious reference to demon possession. You can't get around it any other way. This man is acting a bit strange. Very strange. I want to show you some reference books that have really helped me in this area of demon possession. Now, what I want to do, I've got a graphic about it. I want to hold them up, show what they look like, and then go to the graphic so you can write them down and put it on freeze frame if you have it. Here's the first one. Demons, Demons, Demons by John Newport. Excellent book. I think you'll really like this, but by Broadman. Okay, Demons, Demons, Demons. The next one is going to be Principalities and Powers by John Warwick Montgomery. Excellent little book. So good. And then finally, for those of you who deal with counseling some, Christian Counseling and Occultism, which is one of the most interesting books in this whole area that I've ever read about. On the front it says, medicine, psychiatry, psychology, depth psychology, religious psychology, parapsychology, and theology. And it really does run the gamut. It's an excellent book. Now, let's put the graphic up. We want to show you these so you can write them down. You can just punch your little video machine on freeze frame and get those. I hope you'll buy those. This is a very interesting subject. There's a lot of controversy. There's two extremes here. One of them says there's a demon behind every bush going to jump on all of us. And the other one is there's no such thing as demons. Somewhere in between that is a truth. The New Testament presents the fact there are demons. Now, I believe demons are fallen angels. I don't know a whole lot about them. Not a whole lot is said. They seem to know who Jesus is. They seem to be forced to testify to him. But they're not trying to help him. You can bet on that. Now let's look at him. Had a foul spirit. This man lived among the tombs. That's an imperfect tense. It means settled. Apparently he had been run out of town, and he just took up residence in the graveyard. And that's where he lived. And no one could any longer subdue him, even with a chain. For he had been fastened with fetters and chains, but had snapped the chains and broken the fetters, and no one was strong enough to overpower him. Well, apparently the townspeople, he must have been hassling the people on the road. And so the townsfolks, in some kind of vigilante thing, went out and tried to capture this wild man. And they'd tie him in chains. He'd break the chains. There's nobody could do this guy. He was just an unbelievably powerful person. You know, it amazed me the power of the human body. I remember watching a show recently about people on angel dust, little bitty frail kids, just throwing police officers all over the room. Took six of them to hold one little kid down. It's amazing what the human body can do. And this guy was apparently supernaturally energized by the forces of evil, and he was really wreaking havoc in this area. Snapped these chains, broke them. Notice in verse 5, all night, all day, he kept screaming among the tombs on the hills and kept gashing himself with stones. What a picture. Can you imagine up on the hill outside your town, someone wailing all night long, screaming, and you'd catch him. He apparently was nude, and he'd cut himself with rocks, and you could see him running around the hills and the tombs. Well, I tell you what, the Chamber of Commerce wasn't too pleased on this deal. Now, then it says, let's see. By the way, this gashing with stones, you might want to see 1 Kings 18:28. The prophets of Baal and Ashtaroth did this on Mount Carmel, so it may have had some occultic symbolism. Now, verse 6. On catching a glimpse of Jesus from a distance, he ran up like he's going to hurt him or attack him. And then he fell down at his knees before him. My goodness. And screaming aloud, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name I beg you, do not torture me." What a strange deal. Now, we're at nighttime. This guy's been screaming. He runs up. Can you just see the eyes of those disciples about that big? Now, notice this guy. He's screaming, and it's the demon that's talking. "What do you want with me, Jesus, the Son of the Most High God?" Does that surprise you the demons knew who Jesus is? Well, it shouldn't. In James chapter 2, verse 19, so the demons know as one God. Demons knew all about Jesus. They didn't worship him or serve him, but they certainly knew about him. It says, in God's name, this is really funny. It seems like they're wanting Jesus to swear. It's a Hebrew idiom for an oath. The demons want Jesus to swear in God's name that he won't hurt them. Now, isn't that something? I beg you, do not torture me. And that just shows you the ultimate state. These demons are going to be in a place of torture, the lake that burns with fire. You might well see chapter 1, verses 23 and 24. This thing's happened before. And, wow. "For Jesus was saying to him..." Now, here we have a dialogue in these Greek verb tenses, imperfect tense. "Jesus kept saying to him, 'You foul spirit, come out of him.'" And the demons kept saying, "Now, wait a minute, let me talk to you." Wait. And so they're both talking back and forth to each other. Notice where it says, Jesus asked him, imperfect tense. He kept asking him, "What is your name?" Now, name implies characteristics. And so I don't understand all that's happening here. I'm not a real expert on demons and don't want to be. We know that Mary Magdalene had seven, and so it seems to be intensity. I don't know all that's happening here. He answered, "My name is Legion." Now, in the Roman army, 6,000 soldiers was a regular legion. That is one bunch of demons in one little person. "For we are many." And they kept on earnestly begging him. Jesus kept saying, "Come out of him." The demons kept saying, "Don't send us out of him." And you can just hear that in the middle of the night, can't you? Send them out of the country. And there's been three theories about that. Send them out of the country. Number one, in Luke 8:31, it says, "Into the abyss." Now, the abyss is the great pit, the hole of hell in the Revelation, out of which the locusts with the stingers come in the book of the Revelation. Now, another thing is, don't send them out of the graveyard, out of the tombs. And third, don't send them out of the area of the Decapolis. Now, I don't understand all of that. Apparently, going into a pig is preferable to be sent out of the country, whatever that means. Now, it was a large drove of hogs grazing on the hillside. Now, right there, you wonder what a Jewish boy is doing in a place like this. Well, we're obviously in a Gentile area. We're not in the area where most Orthodox Jews lived, okay? And the demons begged him, "Send us into the hogs." Notice they had to ask permission. Now, why would they want to go in the hogs? Well, apparently going in the hogs was a better place than the abyss. And maybe they'd be able to show their true nature in destroying the hogs. Or maybe, and I really think it's possible, those demons, pretty smart little boys, and they wanted to hurt Jesus any way they could. They knew if they destroyed the hogs, the townspeople would ask Jesus to leave. Is exactly what happens. These demons aren't in this for nothing. So he sends them in the hogs. Now, and notice that they ran off the cliff into the sea and were drowned in perfect tense, one after another. Now, can you get the scene? It's the middle of the night. The disciples row up to land. They're tired. They're weary. Jesus steps out. Here comes a man screaming, naked, cut, a strong man, falls down. He's screaming and hollering. The demons are hollering. Suddenly, the demons go into the pigs. The pigs start squealing, and they're running into the ocean one after another. And suddenly, whoosh, silence. Well, the folks who were keeping the pigs ran to town to tell them. And apparently it's still the middle of the night. These town people, they come out. Now, notice what happened. The hog feeders fled, spread the news in the town and the country around, and the people came to see what had taken place. Isn't it amazing how people are so curious? You know, I've been on the freeway in Houston, my hometown, had one little wreck on one freeway, stops nine lanes of traffic because everybody wants to look at the wreck. Have you ever noticed how it's hard sometimes for fire trucks to get to a fire because everybody wants to watch the fire? We're strange folks. The towns who didn't care a bit about this poor naked man out there, but they wanted to see what happened to the pigs. Now, isn't that funny? More concern for the pigs than was from the man. Okay, verse 15. When they came to see Jesus and saw that the man had once been insane, that's a bad translation, it's demonized man, under the power of many demons, sitting with his clothes on. So apparently he had been naked before. First streaker, if you please. In his right mind, they were frightened, and they begged Jesus to leave their neighborhood. It wasn't joy. They didn't say, boy, thank you for solving this real problem. They were economically concerned, the loss of the pigs. They were frightened at Jesus' power, and they just wanted him out. They said, just please, just leave. Now, the man wants to come with him. He says, oh, please, let me go with you. And Jesus said, no, you go home and tell your folks. First, he says, it's the first home missionary. He says, go back and tell your family. Go back to your loved ones. And then tell everybody what God has done for you. Perfect tense. He's done, and it remains. Boy, what a wonderful thing. So he went away to tell everybody in the 10 cities, that's the Decapolis, it's a Gentile area, how much Jesus had done for him. Everybody was dumbfounded, marveled, imperfect tense, continued to marvel over this wild man turned into a witness and disciple. Now, Jesus crossed over the lake again, and he gets out of the boat, and a man named Jairus. Now, Jairus in Hebrew means whom Yahweh has enlightened. And he was a ruler of a synagogue, which means he was the one that kept the air conditioner turned on, if you please, and the floors mopped. And he just took charge of the physical building and scheduled the speakers. So he was a really important, powerful man in this town. Rich, probably. However, he came up and saw Jesus, flung himself at his feet. Can you imagine this? There's a large crowd. This very wealthy, prosperous, influential man just falls down at Jesus' feet. Tell you what, when your children are hurt, you'll just about do anything, won't you? And he kept earnestly begging, imperfect tense, over and over, my dear little daughter is at the point of death. Now, Matthew 9:18 says she's dead. She was about 12 years old. That was the year she became a full woman in Judaism. Boys become sons of the law at 13. Girls become women at 12. Come lay your hands on her so that she may get well. So he went off with him, and a great crowd kept following him, jostling him. Now, Luke 8:42 tells us the press was so great you almost couldn't breathe. There's a lot of folks. There's a lot of press, this crowd. And then a woman, this is going to interrupt the flow to Jairus' house. And I'm sure Jairus was so impatient at Jesus. A woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had suffered much at the hands of many doctors. Let me ask you a question. Luke 8:43 and 44 leaves this out. Why do you think? Luke's a doctor, and he didn't want any bad PR, to tell you the truth. Now, let me just show you what kind of thing she had done. It says that she had spent all she had and was worse and not a whit benefited, but rather grew worse. Let me just show you some of the things in the Talmud the Jews said that you should do if you wanted to cure a hemorrhage. Now, listen to this. This is from the Talmud. It's documented. Carry the ashes of an ostrich egg in a linen rag in summer and a cotton rag in winter around your neck. Listen to this one. Carry the barley corn from the dung of a female white donkey around your neck. I just soon have a hemorrhage, I think, is that. And this comes from one of the tractates of the Talmud. Can you imagine what this poor woman went through and stinky, messy, dirty remedies? No help. Now, by the way, this hemorrhage made her ceremonially unclean. And she could not touch Jesus. She could not go to the synagogue. She could not participate in worship service. She was almost like a leper because of this continued flow of blood. But she had heard the reports about the Jesus, Yeshua. But she came up in the crowd and touched his coat. Now, what she touched is his prayer shawl called the Talith that had four blue tassels, two in the back, two in the front, that comes from Deuteronomy, symbolizing his dedication to God. And she kept saying to herself over and over, if I can only touch his clothes, I'll get well. If I can only touch his clothes, I'll get well. And her hemorrhage stopped at once, and she felt in her body that she was cured. How about that? You know, Matthew 8:17 quotes Isaiah 53 that says, you know, by his stripes we are healed. This deal about personal miracles of healing cost Jesus something in his own body. This is what he says. At once Jesus perceived that power, now King James has virtue, had gone out from him, so he turned around the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? Now, you want the Old Testament references to the Talith. Numbers 15:38-40 and Deuteronomy 22:12. The disciples said, Lord, everybody's touching you. Look at the size of this crowd. What do you mean, who touched you? Sometimes the disciples were just plumb ignorant. Here's a good example of it. They said, what do you mean, who's touching you? They just didn't perceive. He kept still, imperfect, and kept looking around to see her who had done it. So the woman, as she knew what had taken place, perfect tense, though frightened and trembling. Now, see, the place of women was very low in this culture. She was not accustomed to speaking in public at all, but she came forward, fell on her knees before his feet, and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, my daughter, your faith has cured you. Now, notice, it isn't her magical belief in touch. And it isn't her power of positive thinking. It was the power of Jesus that she believed in that cured her, not just the touch, magical touch, nor her positive thinking. We need to hear that. Go in peace. Now, this is the word ice. Go into wholeness and be free. This is the idea of behold in King James, from your disease. Present imperative is a command to behold. By the way, the word disease comes from the word whip. Is the root. Okay, now, while all this was happening, the lady was healed marvelously. Her faith had made her whole. But Jairus, I bet, was just saying, come on, let's go. Come on, let's go. My daughter. While he was saying this, people came from the house of the leader of the synagogue and said, your daughter is dead, aorist tense. She's died. Why trouble the teacher, the rabbi, any longer? But Jesus paid no attention. Now, paid no attention is in the American Standard Version of the Bible. But the New American Standard and the King James have something like overheard what they were saying. Well, now, the root is, the Greek is to hear carelessly. So it's like he didn't pay any attention to what they said. He just going to say, believe in me. Look what he said to the man. But he said to the leader of the synagogue, do not be afraid. Now, this is a present imperative with a may article, which means stop and act already in process. Do not be afraid. And then he says, keep up your faith. Present imperative, a command. Continue to believe in me. All right? He let no one go with him but Peter, James, and James' brother John. And they came to the house, the leader of the synagogue, and they saw confusion. People were weeping and wailing without restraint. Now, friends, I don't know if you've ever been to a wild funeral here in the United States, but you ever seen nothing like you would in the Orient. Maybe on TV you've seen a documentary of some of the Israeli soldiers dying and how those mothers weep and wail and have to be restrained and fall on the graves and throw dirt in the air. Friends, it is unbelievable culturally how much emotion they express. They probably live longer because of it. But they even hired professional wailers. Now, outside this girl's house, because this man was a very prominent person, there were hired people screaming, wailing, pulling their hair. What a sight it must have been. Oh, my goodness. And here walks up Jesus. Why do you continue all this confusion and crying? Jesus says, the little girl is not dead, but sleeping. And they begin to laugh in his face. Imperative. I mean, imperfect. All of them begin to go, well, you're crazy. Now, the word sleep here is used by Jesus. Look at John 11:11. It's used as a symbol of death. It uses a metaphor of death. But here, the girl's really dead. But he drove them out. That's a strong term. It means he cast them out of the house. And he took the little girl's father and mother and the three men with him and went into the room where the little girl was. And he grasped her hands. Notice, Jesus was not concerned with ceremonial defilement. If the woman with the issue of blood can touch him and he's glad, this little dead girl, he takes her hand and lifts her up. Now, see that? No rabbi could touch a dead person or a ceremonially unclean woman with an issue of blood. Now, and he said, Talitha kum, which is Aramaic for little girl, I tell you, get up. The little girl at once got up and started walking around. She was 12 years old, just became a woman. And instantly they were completely dumbfounded. This means in English, we get the English word ecstasy from this Greek word. And he strictly charged them to let nobody know about it. And he told them to give her something to eat. Now, this is the messianic secret of Mark. I want to crawl the scriptures that show you all the places in Mark that this messianic secret is used. Listen to all these. I think you'll see them in a second. Mark 1:44, Mark 3:12, Mark 5:43, Mark 7:36, Mark 8:26, Mark 9:30, Mark 12:16. Oh, there is just a ton of reference. You say, well, what is this messianic secret? Well, it seems like in Mark that Mark is extremely nervous with anyone who is witnessing about his miracles. For you see, the people really did not know the content of the gospel yet. Now, they knew that Jesus was a great healer. They knew that he had power in his hands, that at his voice things happened. They knew he was a marvelous teacher. But just think for a moment. The gospel is not yet complete. What are they going to share about Jesus? Well, he'd already had problems with these great crowds. There were so many people that he couldn't even teach in the towns anymore. He had to go out in the villages and by the seashore. He did not need this witnessing about that he could raise the dead. It would just compound his problem with crowds. Instead of just sick people, if the Jews believed he could raise the dead, they'd start carrying corpses in the crowds. I tell you what, I think I'd have been afraid to go hear Jesus in that day anyway. There was lepers and all kinds of disease. His crowd was like an outpatient clinic, I want to tell you. And if the word had got out about him here in the dead, they would have had all kinds of coffins and everything. So Jesus says, don't you tell anybody what I've done. Now, nobody listened to him. So he had the problem all his life. But that's the messianic secret in Mark. Once he dies on Calvary, resurrects from the dead, he says, tell it from the rooftops. But he really says, now don't share this. Don't share this. Even the transfiguration, don't share this. Now, a word about this inner disciples, inner circle. I have often wondered why it is that Jesus would just let three come. Well, some folks say these are the inner circle of the church. Well, that can't be true because James is the first one to die. Could it be he liked these three more? You say, oh, Jesus likes everybody. I think Jesus had personal friends like Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Maybe he felt more comfortable about Peter, James, and John. Maybe it's some reason that we don't know. And that's what it is. We don't know why these three and not the others. But over and over, consistently, they're with him. Mount of Transfiguration, these inner times, Garden of Gethsemane, they're with him when the others are not. What it means, I just don't know. I hope this chapter and going through the power of Jesus, last chapter over nature, this chapter over the spiritual realm and over death and over disease, it says something to you. Friends, I know you struggle with these things in your life. You know, the seemingly uncontrollable forces of nature, it wreaks such havoc sometimes. We have this problem with the spiritual realm. I watch some of those scary shows and get so frightened, you know, and 1 John 4:4 is real helpful, which is, of course, based on the teachings of Jesus. And I think when you know when we get physically sick, and even death is something that can't stand the way of us having fellowship with Jesus. You ought to read Romans 8:31 through 38. I think it'll bless you about nothing can separate us from Christ. And I think that's what this is trying to teach. The power of Jesus, his compassion for us, his closeness to us. Now, this deal about the demons, I must admit to you, I struggle with that. I've told the Lord that I'm a little afraid of that. I just prefer not to have any experiential knowledge of that. I have no problem believing in it because I have committed myself to the authority of the Bible, and the Bible presents a clear distinction in the gospel between sickness and demon possession. I don't do many exorcisms in my ministry, not because I don't believe in it, but because probably I just don't know. I don't know how to recognize it. Now, I think if I saw a man naked, gashing himself with stones, breaking chains, I'd kind of surmise the guy had a demon. But I don't meet those kind of folks in Lubbock, Texas very often. So I really can't explain this to you, but those three books I showed you are some of the best books I have ever read on the subject. And I think if you'll get those, and we'll put the graphic up again in just a minute for you to see them again. I think if you get those three books, that you can have a balanced perspective on the subject of demonology. And I like all three of those. John Newport is such a balanced guy. He's such a well-read intellectual, and yet he does have a balance. John Warwick Montgomery is one of the greatest Christian writers around. Any book he writes, I think, is good. Now, this guy, Coach, is a German evangelist, and he's going to try to explain this away any way he can. Psychiatry, psychology, cultural things. He's going to try to explain it every way possible. But these are case studies from Europe in his own ministry, talking with doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists. And it'll surprise you, the power of occultism in our day. I think one reason we don't deal with occultism more is Satan has such crippling inroads in our life and our culture already. He doesn't need to do this supernatural trick on us. We're off in the other ditch of we know it all because of science. But you just talk to any missionaries that come from third world countries, and they'll tell you the power and presence of the demonic in the culture in which they work. It's a frightening thing. I'm just glad that greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world is true for our lives. The Bible has not one example of demons being able to influence or possess Christians. Now, children of unbelievers, yes. Adults, yes, of unbelievers. There's not one example in the New Testament of a demon really having a major impact negatively on a believer. I think our own sin nature is our major problem. And I do think we're tempted by the evil one. I do believe we're in a spiritual battle. You can't believe the Bible and read Ephesians 6, 10 and following and not believe we're in a spiritual battle. And so I don't want to discount it at all. I just want to say I don't think there's a demon behind every tree. But I do think that we are in a spiritual struggle for the hearts and minds of men. And Jesus has shown us the way and overcome for us. I've enjoyed being with you.